Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. The Weekly World View, ladies and gentlemen. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And we're glad to be back with you and hope that you're glad to tune in, as I'm sure you are, to America's fastest streaming podcast, depending on internet speeds and your internet service provider. Thank you very much. It's good to be here. Hey, I want to start in Georgia with two more military fighter jets crashing into each other and crashing to the ground. Yes, last Tuesday night over rural Georgia. Try to say that three times. Rural Georgia. That's right. A couple of Air National Guard fighter jets, F-16s, crashed into each other. Both pilots ejected. They're safe. They're fine. But the jets crashed and burned. And it just strikes me as odd. Had a couple last week, happened to be a Blue Angel, happened to be the other one, the Air Force one. Yes, the Thunderbirds. And here we've got a couple more. So two a week seems to be the new normal in the modern civilized America. And it just strikes me as odd. That's all. I don't remember planes falling out of the sky quite so regularly until the not too recent past. And so that's from the What's Up With That file. It's a new file here. When you just can't, you have no idea what's going on. Just the What's Up With That file. I don't understand. I thought that these military jet fighters were fairly sophisticated and that the pilots were highly trained. And the ground crews, by the way. Highly trained. But there you have it. All right. Now, should I just... trying to think if I had anything interesting happen in my life this week, and I really didn't. Just worked like a slave. I mean like a slave, like a rented mule I worked. And it's very distasteful to have to work so much. So that, you know, it's only recently, probably since I turned 40, so it's not that recent anymore, actually. I started to really notice how time is extremely valuable and fleeting. I hadn't really, you know, actually, it's since I turned about 45. Time is fleeting ever more rapidly every day. And you get to the end of each day and you realize just how little time you have. And it's just, well, there you have it. That's all. But I'm taking an hour out of my week every week just for you so that I can help you to understand what's going on and not what to think about it. But at least let you know what I think about it. And I think the trannies are out of control. Yes, I said the trannies are out of control. And it's not so much the trannies. It's the people who are encouraging the trannies who are out of control. They're hurting not only the trannies themselves by encouraging them in their mental delusion. They're also hurting society and they're hurting children by causing children to question whether or not boy and girl is just boy and girl, and it's a binary system, and that's all there is to it. I can't imagine what kids 20 years from now, they'll just be so confused. Unless something dramatic happens to get the tranny advocates back under control. But I want to go immediately then, on that note, to the decline and fall of Western civilization file, and to properly document the continuing decline and fall of said Western civilization. We will go to Haines, Alaska, where there is a senior in high school who is a sprinter, and she has made state history in Alaska. She's the first transgender student athlete to compete individually. So I should have said he. But although these stories can be kind of confusing, as you read through the story, it becomes clear that this is a boy dressing as a girl and then competing against girls in track and field. And in fact, this tranny was competing for a high school state championship last week. And the USA Today calls this a progressively historical event. Yes. Now, the boy dressed up like a girl and then beat the girls. Well, he didn't beat all of them. I think he came in third on one. Yeah, he came in third place in one event, which has got to be kind of embarrassing. I mean, you dress up like a girl, you'd think he'd at least be able to beat the girls, but at least two of the girls beat him. Well, there are some family, what do I call these people? I'm sorry, I've drawn a blank here just for a moment. Pro-family industry advocates up there with Alaska Family Action, Jim Minnery, and some others. They gathered outside the state track meet where the tranny was competing against the girls, and they met there to protest. They met outside the track meet. Jim Minnery says, quote, "We are here today to ensure that female athletes are not denied opportunities and scholarships." He made the point that female students could lose spots on the track team, the soccer team, the volleyball team, to male students who identify as female. So Jim Minnery standing up for the rights of high school girls to be on the team. And Jim, that's the least of the problems here with this. The major problem is you have a deluded, confused child, boy, dressing up like a girl, and then you have deluded administrators and parents allowing the delusional one who needs help to compete against the girls. So the fact that girls might lose their spot on the track team is the least of the issues here, Jim. But just leading me to believe that Alaska Family Action is just another pro-family industry. They're afraid to stand up and say this is wrong. It's wrong for a boy to dress like a girl, and it's even more wrong for that boy to compete against the girls in track and field as if he's a girl. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. It should not be tolerated. And to encourage such behavior is, in fact, criminal behavior. You see, that's what the true pro-family advocate should say. Because let's remember what the family is about. It's about one man and one woman marrying and having children. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for transgenderism. I'm sorry. But Jim Minnery, he's probably got a fundraising strategy based on Title IX and how girls could be denied. And he's probably got the fundraising letters all ready to go out over the next few weeks. Talking about God or morality or the family is certainly not a part of Alaska Family Action's fundraising strategy. And it would seem to me that they don't really care that much about the mental health or the soul of this transgendered sprinter. Because if they cared a lot, they would issue some tough love for this deviant and his deviant parents and the deviant administrators who are encouraging him in his mental illness. That's all. Let's see here. The tranny sprinter is a Thai native who was born a male and identifies as a female. What does that mean, to identify as a female? That means to convince all the people around you to encourage you in your mental illness. That's what identifying as something other than your natural born sex is. And that's just what this tranny has achieved, and probably mostly at the encouragement of his parents. Let's see. The tranny decided to run in track this year to provide an example for other transgendered students. And the Haines High School administration there in Alaska stood behind the teen in his quest to make Alaska history, which has been made, I suppose, some sort of history, anyway. You know, history in and of itself, making history in and of itself, is not necessarily meritorious, can be detrimental, but indeed some sort of history has been made in Alaska with a boy being allowed to compete against the girls in track and field. Just unbelievable. Well, I guess it's not unbelievable. Let's see. Do we have a quote here? Should I quote this person? I'm not going to quote this person. Let's see here. The tranny qualified and competed in a Class 3A girls sprints at the state meet, capturing third place in the 200-meter dash and fifth place in the 100. You know what you have here? A really lousy male athlete who probably would have finished 16th had he competed against the boys, and he's finishing third and fifth, and everybody celebrates. Now, who celebrates finishing fifth? Only if you're a tranny. They'll celebrate. Anyway, I feel genuine sorrow for this young lad in his state of confusion, and that the adults around him have no idea how to help him. Oh, finishing fifth is wonderful. You're so great. Yes, you're a girl. You're whatever you want to be. Mommy loves you. Sad, sad state of affairs. Meanwhile, over in the Queering of America file, we go to the NBA, that is the National Basketball Association, in the past, a staunchly heterosexual organization, as far as we all know. What with Wilt Chamberlain and all that. Now, at least heterosexual is all I'm saying, okay? Well, the NBA has launched a new marketing campaign featuring 30 shirts bearing rainbow-colored themes of the team logos to benefit an advocacy group for homosexuals and other sex perverts. There's several groups, as a matter of fact. They're celebrating LGBT Pride Month. Pride, I said, with a capital P. And LGBT Pride organizers say, we are excited to announce a new collaboration between the NBA, GLSEN, and Teespring. These are advocacy groups. We've made a deal with the NBA. They're going to release T-shirts featuring homophobic logos of all NBA teams in support of GLSEN, GLSEN, which is the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, just in case you didn't know, and you should know. So the Homo, Lesbian, Straight Education Network pushes the discussion of homosexuality in kindergarten through 12th grade at the public schools. This is reason number 1,050-something. How many reasons do you need? It's 1,058, I believe, to get or keep your kids out of the government schools, because the GLSEN homos could show up and corrupt your child's thinking by planting seeds of doubt about your child's sex. And that's the last thing you need planted in your child. Let's see. One conference sponsored by GLSEN in previous years featured speakers explaining the practice of fisting to high school students. Fisting, I said. No, don't look it up. You don't want to know. And you certainly don't want your teenage son to know what it's all about. Things that typically weren't discussed until your child had joined the Navy are now common fare in the public high school. And the NBA is all on board to support a group that tells young children about deviant sex. Yeah. Let's see here. The founder of GLSEN, Kevin somebody, led the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools for Barack Obama, where he was appointed. This is the group that talks to high school kids about how to defile one another in a homosexual fashion, by the way. Barry Obama appointed him to lead the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, meaning he is clean as a whistle to work with the NBA, and the NBA is absolutely happy to work with this pervert. So we have a twofer here. Reason number 667 to stop watching the NBA or supporting them in any way. And, of course, reason number 1058, to get or keep your kids out of the government schools. And probably a good reason to cancel TNT and ESPN on your cable because of all these perverts. All right. Now, we go to the war file, where the worst terror attack in U.S. history since 9/11 occurred on Saturday night in Orlando, Florida. 50 people killed inside a nightclub, 53 injured. The terrorist was a fellow named Omar, believe it or not. Omar, do we have his whole name here? Omar Siddiqui Mateen. His parents are from Afghanistan. It looks like he was born in the United States. Police say that, number one, the terrorist was shot and killed at the scene of the terrorist attack in the nightclub in Orlando. And the police say it appears that the terrorist was well-organized and well-prepared for the assault. Authorities say they consider the violence an act of domestic terror. They have suggestions or clues that Omar Siddiqui Mateen has leanings toward Islamic terrorism. So here we have another Islamic terrorist slaughtering people at a nightclub, not unlike what happened in Paris at the Bataclan, at the rock concert. Authorities are also looking into the possibility that the attack was a hate crime. A hate crime? How could someone walking into a nightclub with weapons and just shooting everyone in sight, how could that be considered hateful? Oh, it's because the nightclub is a gay bar. It's a homosexual nightclub. Yes. Now, the terrorist, Omar Siddiqui Mateen, called 9/11 prior to the attack and pledged allegiance to ISIS over the phone. He praised the Boston bombers, and as far as we can tell, made no mention of hating homosexual people or planning to kill homosexual people, only that he was loyal to the Islamic State. And then, of course, he carried out what Islamic State terrorists carry out. They find large crowds of people in a tightly packed building, preferably in the dark, and then they shoot them. Yeah, he apparently didn't mention homos in any way. So we don't know why he attacked this homo club. We don't know how he knows about it. Was it because it was a gay bar, or was it because of a large crowd of people in the dark at 2 o'clock in the morning? Well, the facts will all come out. But the fact is that Islamists are amongst us. They are amongst us, and they are radicalized, and they are poised and ready to do us harm. Whether we're in our nightclubs or our shopping malls or, God forbid, in our churches, and our governing officials are helpless to prevent what occurred in Orlando and what any sane and rational person should assume is going to occur more and more moving forward. And how are we supposed to, are we to petition the government now to say, hey, can you protect us from madmen with guns shouting Allahu Akbar and slaughtering us in the streets? Could you please protect us from that? And in the meantime, the politicians are all out scoring political points on all this, while the blood hasn't even dried on the sidewalk outside of this nightclub. The Democrats are saying this and that about the Republicans. The Republicans are saying this and that about the Democrats. Trump is this, Hillary is this, Mitt Romney said this. And the sad fact is that this attack has done a couple of things. It's shown us how vulnerable we all are. And it has also emboldened the homosexualists to even a higher level of capital P pride. And we're back. It's the Weekly Worldview, ladies and gentlemen. While the precarious nature of civilization has been exposed in the slaughter in Orlando, and we watch Western civilization cringe and cower and quiver, either being killed by our enemies or killing ourselves, we look to the Swiss for some level of encouragement, believe it or not. And that's when you know you're in trouble. when you're looking to the Swiss for some level of encouragement. But on a positive note, ladies and gentlemen, almost 80% of Swiss voters have rejected a guaranteed monthly income. They were offered just that by the socialist politicians running the socialist utopia of Switzerland. That's right, the politicians came and they said, we'll guarantee you an income of, sustenance, $2,500 a month. We'll just give that to everybody, slacker, loser, entrepreneur, superstar, megastar, everyone except the politicians. See, the politicians, they have there's a certain pay rate to which they've become accustomed. So they weren't saying that they were going to lower themselves to the $2,500 a month, but they were going to offer that to all the slack-jawed losers who vote for them. And the Swiss said no. According to the legislation that was proposed, children under the age of 18 would receive a check for about $650 a month, and adults, able-bodied or otherwise, would receive about $2,500 a month. Apparently, the millennials had gathered 100,000 signatures in order to put this to a public vote in Switzerland, a popular initiative. So it wasn't that the politicians straight up offered this to the people. It's just that they have so miseducated the younger generation that the younger generation demanded it. And the adults in Switzerland said no. No, you can't have $2,500 a month. Apparently, this idea of a basic income guarantee, or a BIG, isn't that cool? A BIG? Sounds like a hip-hop song. Come and get your BIG on the LSMFT. All right, you? Yeah. Well, the adults in Switzerland said no to the BIG, but this idea has apparently some currency with the leftists in Europe, and more recently, prominent libertarians have also embraced the idea of a basic income guarantee because the libertarians say it's a cheaper, more efficient alternative to the current welfare state. So it could save us a few francs. So why not just guarantee all the losers $2,500 a month and be done with it? It would save us a lot of money. We have an associate professor of philosophy at the University of San Diego who wrote in an essay for the Cato Institute, a formerly conservative organization. I don't know that they're conservative or they ever have been. Conservatives have been members of Cato, but it's always been a libertarian organization, I think. And when I first heard of it, I thought it had to do with cat lovers, the Cato Institute. And then I thought maybe it has to do with karate. Cato? Anyway, I have no idea what that is. That's just what I thought when I was 10 or 11 years old. Then I heard the Cato Institute. I first thought it was for cats or people who like cats. And then later I thought it was about karate. I don't know, just because the name Cato. It's not really funny or interesting. It's just what I thought of when I was like 11. Oh, that's right. It's a support group for friends of O.J. Simpson. Anyway. All right, we've taken that too far. But this professor wrote an essay for the Cato Institute saying, wouldn't it be better just to scrap the whole welfare system and just write the poor a check? Just write them a check. It's unbelievable how, you know, without God and his standards of objective morality, eventually even intelligent people devolve into complete idiots. An associate professor of philosophy. What is an associate manager or an associate professor? I think that's like an assistant manager at Del Taco. Assistant professor. That means the real professor makes this guy do all the grunt work, digging through, researching. Anyway, he's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of San Diego, and he says we should just write the poor a check. Come on. Co-designers of the Swiss referendum. The two of the millennials who wrote this popular referendum there in Switzerland guaranteeing an income. They said, well, at least if we had a basic income guarantee, then entrepreneurs could be sure that people who come to work for them are coming because they actually want to work. Implying that there's an awful lot of people out there who show up just to collect a paycheck and do as little work as possible, which is absolutely true. But the last thing you want to do is subsidize the poor in their self-destruction. You don't want to take away somebody's motivation to work. That's akin to murder, to take away someone's motivation to work. And besides, even the people who just show up and try to get along and do as little as possible, even they end up contributing to society because eventually someone actually makes them work. You can only hide in your cubicle for so long before someone eventually makes you do some actual work that is productive for society. Let's see, a majority of Switzerland doesn't buy the argument that this is going to help. They believe it would cripple the Swiss economy by eliminating all motivation for work. An economics professor at Geneva Graduate Institute told reporters that, well, if you pay people to do nothing, they will do nothing. Wow, what an insightful statement. And you know, the thing in Switzerland, you've only got about 10% of the society doing anything as it is. The last thing you want to do is undermine that. The whole society will collapse. And the same goes for Western Europe and more for the United States. So this is a totally insane idea, a basic income guarantee. And the people of Switzerland said no. But in Finland and the Netherlands, they're launching a similar trial program in the near future. Over in Finland, starting in 2017, nearly 200,000 Finns will begin receiving a basic income of $600-800 a month. So they're going to run the experiment. That's what kind of surprised me about this story. I was like, the Europeans don't already have this? I would have thought they already had this. Proving that civilization is not necessarily as far gone as we might think. Let's see, over in Finland, they're going to have four varieties of the basic income system to be tested among thousands of citizens and then later compared to the current system. So the utilitarians who are running Finland are basically going to run the numbers. And if the numbers work out, they don't care how many poor people they destroy. They don't care how many young people are stripped of their motivation to excel and be successful. As long as the numbers work out, they'll just guarantee money to turn people into losers. And that's criminal. And yes, it's just all right. Now, I was informed this past week that Houston has a new mayor. Yes. Now, you may or may not be aware of my legendary, I did a legendary bit on Anise Parker, who was the openly lesbian mayor of Houston, who was sworn in on a big fat Bible that her grandma used to carry, and then praised by Joel Osteen. It's on the internet now. The original version got close to 100,000 views before it was, it just disappeared. We don't know what happened to it. The current version only has about 6,000 views, so we that put us over 100,000. But the original's gone. So someone told me that Anise Parker is no longer the mayor in Houston, and I went to the official Houston mayor's website, and I saw a picture of the new mayor, and I thought to myself, well, his name is Sylvester, and is it possible that they actually have a new mayor? Or did Anise Parker transition recently? Maybe she's the first sitting mayor to undergo both a sex change and a race change operation, if there is such a thing. I'll post the picture of the new mayor of Houston next to a picture of Anise Parker, and you people can be the judge. Do they actually have a new mayor, or did Anise change her name to Sylvester and undergo some sort of, it's going on everywhere. So I had a friend, a business associate, who I was supposed to do an event on Saturday, and he had to fly in. He was in Oklahoma City, and he was trying to get to Denver via Dallas when he was told that there had been gunfire at the Dallas Love Field Airport. All flights to Dallas were canceled. He had to spend the night in Oklahoma City until things settled down in Dallas. And he barely made the event on Saturday morning, but he did a bang-up job, I must say, for a guy who had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning after worrying all night that terrorists were shooting up Dallas Love Field. Of course, what did you think he thought? He thought there must be terrorists at the Dallas airport. There's people being... So what actually happened, though, according to the Dallas News, was a police officer opened fire at Dallas Love Field Airport last Friday after a man rushed at him with a large rock. The suspect was shot. The woman he was with and the officer were unhurt. And so my business associate, as he's following the news, he's thinking, is it a terrorist? Is it a terrorist couple? He heard there was a man and a woman involved. And it turns out it was just another domestic detonation. A domestic relationship in which one of the partners in that relationship had decided to kill or do severe harm to the other. And it just so happened to have taken place at Dallas Love Field Airport. And the man who was shot and killed was not a terrorist in any way. He was just somebody mad at his girlfriend, or vice versa. Just another domestic detonation shutting down Dallas Love Field and leaving my business associate stranded in Oklahoma City, which, well, Oklahoma City, if you have to be stranded, there's a lot worse places you could be than Oklahoma City. Although I can't think of one off the top of my head. Ah, Gallup, New Mexico. He could have been stranded in Gallup, New Mexico. And take it from me and my extremely attractive audio engineer, that Gallup, New Mexico is no place you want to be stranded for any period of time. But while we all sit and contemplate terrorism and the Islamic State and all of that, and that there's a certain level of social tension built in now because of the terrorists and what they've been able to carry out now multiple times on U.S. soil, remember that while the Islamist, In his heart of hearts, he wants to kill us and hurt us. Every day it is the humanists who have taught us about no-fault divorce and shacking up and the idea that there are no moral absolutes when it comes to human relationships and we should just be able to haphazardly engage in sexual relations with just about anyone at any time and everything will be fine and nobody gets hurt. And at the end of it, if it doesn't work out, you just have a no-fault divorce and everything's good. It's the humanists that kill more Americans every year than the Islamists ever will. That's why everybody wants a piece of the action. Everybody needs a main attraction. I got what everybody needs. Satisfaction guarantees. Everybody wants a piece of the It's the Weekly Worldview. I am Doug McBurney, joined in studio today by my extremely attractive audio engineer. And we go now to the Weekly Worldview Everyday Hero File. Yes, the Everyday Hero here at the Weekly Worldview. This week, well, we go to Southern Oregon where a bicycle was stolen from a bike rack outside a Walmart in Eagle Point, a rural town about 170 miles south of Eugene, if you're familiar with the area, and I am. The Guardian in London reports that the woman who owned the bike gave chase on foot, but she was unable to catch the thief. Yes. And that brings up, before we get to the everyday hero part, when does a thief become a thief? Does he become a thief upon due conviction in a court of law? Or does he become a thief when he steals the bicycle? So I would posit to you that a thief becomes a thief when he steals the bicycle. That's all. Now, there may not be an official record of the theft until he is duly convicted in court, but the minute he got on that bike, he became a thief. And how do we know? And see, the thing is, lawyers and increasingly urinalists all over the country who go to urinalism school are taught that they can never use terms like thief or murderer or anything like that until the conviction is complete. Well, I'm telling you, a thief becomes a thief as soon as he jumps on the bicycle seat. I can prove it. Because of what happened in the ensuing moments, what happened was there was a rancher who happened to be in the parking lot of said Walmart, just 170 miles south of Eugene, in Eagle Point. And he jumped down, he pulled his horse down out of the trailer. He's watching this woman chase this thief across the parking lot. Takes his horse down out of the horse trailer, mounts up, and chased the thief down and roped him. He roped the thief around the ankles, dragged him to the ground violently, possibly injuring the man, and held him until police arrived. Now, what proves that the man was a thief was that nobody got angry at the cowboy. In fact, people were cheering him. The thief, by the way, was arrested and charged with theft. His name was Vittorino Ariano Sanchez. He got roped by the cowboy. Do we have the cowboy's name? Robert Borba. Robert Borba is a rancher in Southern Oregon. He says, well, I seen this fellow get up to speed on that bicycle. I knew I wasn't going to catch him on foot. I just don't run very fast. But I use a rope every day. That's how I make my living, and if it catches cattle pretty good, it catches a bandit pretty good, too. He said. Well, I'm affecting the Texas accent in support of my fellow Texans. I grew up in Texas briefly, from the age of 9 until the age of 18, so that I think that qualifies me to call myself a Texan, even though I wasn't born there. Anyway, not a lot. This is almost like a cowboy novel, this article from The Guardian. The reporter says, not a lot is known about Mr. Borba because he's new in town. He's new in town.
So maybe he is from Texas.
He might be from Texas. But it appears that even though we don't know Mr. Borba, said one local resident, he said it appears he will be a good fit. Eagle Point's a small city and people watch out for each other, and that's exactly what he did. A witness said he would love to buy the cowboy a beer, and he said this guy should be our next president. Proving that everybody knows that the guy on the bike was already a thief, even though he wasn't convicted. Because if there was any doubt, then Mr. Borba would have been arrested for roping a guy. A man who, well, we don't know if he's innocent or not. He's innocent until proven guilty, you see. Well, then how come you're not mad at the guy who roped him? It's because deep down in your confused little heart, you know that the guy was a thief the minute he jumped on that bike. And so did the cowboy. All right. Now, another point I'd like to make here. No matter what the temperament of this cowboy is, or his life experience, his managerial skills, his executive skills, communication skills, no matter what the state of any of those are, I will guarantee you that our nation would be just as good off with this fellow in the White House as either of the two that are running right now. If the presidency just suddenly fell into the lap of this cowboy as he was on his horse and he had the thief by the ankles, guarantee that we would be just as good with this guy as we would with either one of the bozos who are running. In fact, I'll be even more bold. I would say that if we just held a lottery, all you have to do is own land, be married to someone of the opposite sex, and have children, and you qualify for this lottery. And then we drew the name out of a giant barrel of 100 million names, at any name you pick, we would be better off with that person than either of the two egomaniac, crazy people running for president right now. They are filled with avarice. They are self-promoters. They are the most ruthlessly, nakedly ambitious people in the country right now. That's how they end up running for president. Because that's what democracy does. It ends up devolving to the most nakedly ambitious, dishonest, self-promoting people. They'll end up floating to the top. So if we just had a lottery, we would end up with someone better than either one of those two. Yeah. And by the way, one more thing on this story of the cowboy. What was his name? Robert Borba, who did his duty as a citizen and roped this thief. This thief will be released fairly soon. He may be out of jail already. And this is a new twist on the catch and release program. And normally the police handcuff, and then the thief is processed through the system. Money exchanges hands between lawyers and other people, judges, and then the thief is released. It's the catch and release program. But this one involved a lasso, which made it a little more interesting, but every bit is detrimental to the state of justice in America. I wonder if we can find out if this thief has been released. Vittorino Arellano Sanchez. Let's see. Let's put a little flag by his name here. See, there's a flag. Put that by his name. We're going to follow up and find out how long this fellow spent in jail. My guess is that the cowboy had barely gotten back to the ranch before Mr. Sanchez was already out of jail. And that's just sad. That's the Everyday Hero File from the Weekly Worldview. Thank you very much. Now, on a sad day, and this is a sad day, with the biggest body count in the war on terror on American soil since September 11th, 2001, hanging over us, and a certain level of apprehension and fear now, anytime you're in a large crowd in public in a metropolitan area, there's going to be a certain level of, whether it's subliminal or it percolates out to the top, there's concern. People are concerned. But even without the Islamists, I want to go back to the humanists. The humanists who have educated, everybody, myself included. I was educated by a bunch of humanist, socialist, public school parasites. People who couldn't have made a living in any other way, parasitically attaching themselves to the state and allegedly teaching children. That's what I was victimized by in the government schools. And you were victimized in similar fashion if you went there. And if you send your kids there, they're being victimized in similar fashion. And we're ending up with a generation of young adults completely unmoored from not only morality and a sound understanding of right and wrong, but increasingly unmoored from reality. Case in point, we go to the domestic tranquility file, where a young singer named Christina Grimmie, who had come to some notoriety on a television show called The Voice. It's one of these competitive singing shows. I happened to have a friend who appeared on this show and made the finals, as did young Christina Grimmie. She made the finals, and even though she didn't win, she was enjoying something of a music career. She was doing a concert in Orlando Friday night, the same city where ISIS attacked on Saturday night. Well, so Saturday night, the Islamists attacked, but Friday night, the fruit of the godless human experiment that America has been undergoing for at least my lifetime, the fruit of that experiment attacked, and a young man shot and killed this singer after she had just finished performing a concert. She's hanging out, signing autographs. And a young man walked up to her and shot her dead. Her brother immediately tackled the suspect. There was a struggle, and the suspect shot himself dead. Orlando. Isn't that the Magic Kingdom? Or no, is that right? Yeah, the Magic Kingdom's in Orlando. Disney World. Just sad. So it's the confluence of humanism and Islamism is producing just blood in the streets every day, violence and the shedding of innocent blood and tears and fear. There's a general fear in the population. And it's just sad, a sad commentary on a civilization where at one time, at least I can recall this, and maybe I was delusional, but I remember being able to walk around and generally not being afraid of anything bad happening. I knew that if anything bad happened to me, it would probably be because of my own bad decision-making. I certainly wasn't worried about a domestic situation erupting into gunfire and violence, and I was not concerned about fanatic Islamists blowing up a mall or a nightclub where I might have found myself. I just remember I wasn't generally worried about that. But now I am. I am somewhat concerned at all times. That's all. Because there are crazies amongst us, both Islamic and otherwise. Case in point, the judiciary. Go to the justice file where in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Fox 43 News reports that a Harrisburg man, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, has been sentenced for raping a six-year-old boy. The man admitted to raping the boy. He also admitted to knowing he was HIV positive. This pervert, along with another pervert, were not only charged with raping the boy, but also with the creation of and possession of child pornography after one of the perverts live-streamed video on the internet of their crime against a six-year-old boy. The video showed one of the perverts drugging the child, both men abusing him, and then the actual rape. The man who raped the boy has been sentenced to 17 and a half to 40 years in prison, followed by 66 and one-third years consecutive supervision for raping a six-year-old boy. So if you and I cannot agree that these two perverts deserve the death penalty, then you and I cannot live peaceably together, because I believe you are mentally ill and dangerous and quite possibly criminal. If you don't see that these two must be put to death with extreme prejudice, then you are part of the problem. Back, it's the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney. During the break, my extremely attractive audio engineer asked if the six-year-old boy survived. Did he die? He survived. He did not die. But it is as if he were murdered. His life has been taken from him to a certain degree, for which these two should pay the ultimate penalty, publicly and painfully. And the day will come when they will. That day will come. Because there is justice. And the reason there is justice is because there is a God, a living God. And I will prove it to you right now for you skeptics. Go to the justice file. And walk with me, if you will, through the very first case in which DNA evidence helped to secure a conviction. I caught this on Forensic Files earlier in the week. My extremely attractive audio engineer and I, we watch Forensic Files, and that's just about it on TV. Who can watch TV? What, sitcoms? Dramas? I can't relate. But to Forensic Files, I can relate. Because while the crimes themselves can be horrific and disgusting, there is a certain amount of satisfaction that one gains in seeing how the good guys catch the bad guys. And in this case, the bad guy, well, turned out to be one Colin Pitchfork. He's the first man to be convicted of murder on the basis of DNA evidence. And in 1983, a young girl was strangled to death after being raped. Her name was Linda Mann. This is in the United Kingdom. Pulled the story from the Daily Mail. Did some research after seeing a Forensic Files episode. And it turns out that this fella has been in the news fairly recently. This is from 1983. Linda Mann was strangled to death after being raped. 3 years later, Don Ashworth was raped and murdered less than a mile from where Linda had been murdered. Now, DNA is interesting. A British scientist, Alec Jeffries, developed DNA profiling in the 1980s. And DNA can be extracted from samples of human cells found at a crime scene, including blood, semen, skin, saliva, mucus, perspiration, and the roots of hair. And profiling using DNA can even be carried out on old and dried out samples. In the cases of Linda Mann and Don Ashworth, both raped and murdered, initially, a young mentally retarded fella named Richard Buckland, a local 17-year-old, was browbeaten by the police into confessing to the murder of Don Ashworth, the second young lady who was killed in 1986. He confessed to her murder, but he did not confess to the murder of the first young lady, Linda Mann, and the police were convinced that the two were connected, but he did not confess to her murder, Richard Buckland, the 17-year-old mentally disabled young man. So using Sir Alec Jeffries' new DNA technique, scientists compared the semen samples with a blood sample from Richard Buckland, and the sample proved that both girls were murdered by the same man, first. But secondly, the DNA proved that this man was not Richard Buckland. So the young man who had been browbeaten by the police into confessing, the mentally disabled young man, turned out to be innocent of this crime, and he turned out to be the first person exonerated by God. You can insert God for DNA because DNA is the handwriting of the finger of the living God. And before DNA ever convicted anyone, it first exonerated a man. Mr. Buckland was exonerated. Later, DNA from Colin Pitchfork was found to have matched the samples taken from the crime scene of both schoolgirls, and Pitchfork was jailed for life in 1988. He was jailed for life. That's in England, that doesn't mean life, of course, just like here. He received a minimum 30-year sentence, which was then somehow negotiated down to 28 years in 2009, meaning that Colin Pitchfork was set to be eligible for release, or at least to apply for parole in 2016, which he did, and parole was denied in April of 2016, just a couple of months ago. And so Colin Pitchfork will continue to apply for parole as long as he lives and breathes, which he should not be able to do. But he will do it, despite the fact that he was convicted by God, an undeniable source, his own DNA. But keep in mind that God is just, undeniably just, provably just, in that God's handwriting exonerated a man before it ever convicted a man. Richard Buckland was exonerated by the handwriting of the living God. Let God be true and every man a liar. And I can tell you just about every man involved with the sentencing of Colin Pitchfork is indeed a liar. But I found that case to be very fascinating. And, well, we will find out what happens to Colin Pitchfork on this side. And then, of course, we'll all be there for Judgment Day to meet Colin Pitchfork on the other side. And what a day that will be. Now, let's go from the justice file will return across the pond back to America. If you remember the case of Brittany Maynard, this is from the National Suicide File. Brittany Maynard, you'll remember, committed suicide in public, in front of God and everybody, with the assistance of her husband and her family. She was suffering from brain cancer, and she has become the poster girl for assisted suicide, which is murder suicide. She's become the poster girl, as I had predicted, and now her husband has written an article for CNN that appeared on their website, and his ghostwriter in the very first paragraph, in my opinion, his ghostwriter came up with a fairly effective device. He says, "My wife, Brittany, I held her in my arms as she fell asleep and passed away peacefully. She did so after consuming aid in dying medication instead of allowing brain cancer to continue imposing its slow and torturous death upon her." So a nice literary device, pull at the heartstrings. Mr. Maynard writes this article in celebration of a new California law that will be going into effect, went into effect last week, to give others, quote, the option of a similarly gentle passing if it becomes necessary. Mr. Maynard is celebrating the End of Life Option Act, which he insists was inspired by Brittany, and indeed I'm sure it was, in the minds of the criminally deranged people running California. Mr. Maynard writes, for most individuals, end of life, palliative, and hospice care will provide a gentle passing. But there are certain cases when this might only be accomplished with the option of suicide. There might be certain cases that might. And so we've put into place now in California a law that allows doctors to kill people. At their own request, of course. Mr. Maynard writes that Brittany chose to live her life on her own terms, and I feel a profound sense of pride. Yes, a profound sense of pride. Capital P, pride. He goes on to say, to be clear, the goal of terminally ill individuals is to live as long as they possibly can. At which point I have to stop Mr. Maynard and say, if you have to preface a statement by, to be clear, well, that means you haven't been clear. Because you've been promoting suicide throughout the article, but suddenly you stop and say, now, to be clear, meaning I haven't been clear, we don't want to kill anyone who wants the terminally ill to live as long as possible. But in fact, he's promoting suicide. He says, the reality is that with a population of almost 40 million in California, there might be hundreds of terminally ill individuals in Brittany's situation. And while much of the public will likely remember how Brittany died, those who knew her best will agree that it's the way Brittany lived that is her true legacy. A legacy, yes. Some kind of legacy, I suppose. Sure, the promotion of suicide in the last years of her life and her cowardice in the face of death is some sort of legacy. This law, the End of Life Option Act, the beginning of suicide in California, the beginning of legal doctor-assisted suicide. That's some kind of legacy, I suppose, yeah. We all leave some kind of legacy. I mean, Jim Jones had some kind of legacy. A legacy, no doubt. And so shall Brittany Maynard and her mentally deranged husband, who is now supporting the suicide of a nation, or at least a state there in California. That takes us further into the decline and fall of Western civilization file, where a new study from the University of New Hampshire tells us that 2015 witnessed the lowest fertility rate on record in the United States, and they blame The Great Recession. Yes. The Washington Examiner talks about, well, I think it's not the Examiner. I think it's the researchers. They say more than 5 years after economists announced the end of the recession, fertility levels have still not recovered. Almost 3.5 million fewer babies were born in the United States between 08 and 2015 than would have been expected. This coincides with Barry Ho's presidency, by the way. A massive decline in the birth rate. And oddly enough, researchers indicate that there were more women of childbearing age living in the United States during the period of time in which the fertility rates collapsed for all intents and purposes. And other researchers say that there is no evidence that births will be on the rise soon, despite some reports that the economy is improving. So they're blaming the economy and ignoring the collapse of our society. The moral and spiritual collapse of the society is what's responsible for the declining birth rate. It's not the economy. I mean, if people aren't working, they're generally home and they don't have as much going on, they probably have more kids. But it's not that. I mean, take a look at society, the gamers, the homos, the potheads, the self-absorbed narcissists, the abortion pills. That's why the birth rate is declining. It's not the economy. It's the godlessness. Godlessness that leads to no hope, and no hope leads to no kids. And that's where we are, here at the precipice, as enemies from without compete with enemies from within to see who can do more damage and destruction to the country. Speaking of enemies within, from the decline and fall file, from Falls Church, Virginia, Fairfax County Public Schools have voted to include gender identity in a non-discrimination policy, meaning that you cannot discriminate against young children who've been abused and miseducated by their parents and the society in general and taught that they can't really be sure of what sex they are. So they had a big meeting at the auditorium at the Luther Jackson Middle School in Falls Church, where dozens of mentally deranged parents stood in support of the school system's protections for transgendered students. One hapless father who didn't want to be named said, well, my little girl, she's actually kind of afraid of boys, and now she has boys coming into the bathroom. What's a hapless father to do? Reason number 1057 to get or keep your children out of the government schools, whether you're in Falls Church, Virginia, or elsewhere. By the way, little history on Falls Church. I took a wild guess, and I thought maybe Falls Church, Virginia was actually named after a church. Well, it turns out it was named after the Falls Church in the 18th century. It was the Church of England wished to make inroads into the vast wilderness of northern Virginia, and the colony's leaders viewed the church as a beachhead of civilization in the wild as well, and the Falls Church was founded. Attendees who went to the Falls Church? Influential men early in American history, men like George Mason and George Washington. So Falls Church has gone from George Washington to trannies in the girls' room. And I don't know what to say about that. What would George Washington think if you were holding a school board meeting to discuss whether or not... I just can't imagine that George Washington could even comprehend that the conversation would be taking place. And he would certainly weep at what has happened to the nation that he honorably bequeathed to us, and that so many of us have irresponsibly squandered away. And it hangs in the balance, and I'm glad that you and I are hanging together so that we can at least warn the mentally deranged what they're doing to themselves and quite possibly help save them from themselves. That's it for the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. I'll return next week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com. I want to thank my friends at American Right to Life. And, of course, my other brother, Darryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studio. Should the Lord tarry, we shall return. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.